The category under which this paper is included, historical problems, assumes the self-evidential thesis that there are elements in the gospel narratives which do not ring true to social and religious conditions as we otherwise know them to have existed in Palestine at the turn of the era. Much of what we've heard and shall hear during the course of this symposium supports this point of view. But any constructive analysis of the New Testament records can't rest content with a simple arithmetical equation, fact equals the possible minus the less likely and downright impossible. That is, that if we go on peeling away the skins of improbability from the onion, we shall end eventually with a small kernel of historical fact on which to build some new theory about the historical Jesus, who he was, who his parents were, where he was really born and lived, how he spent his formative years, whether he was a well-meaning if somewhat ineffective political subversive, or just a religious reformer who annoyed the Roman and Jewish authorities and paid the price of nonconformity. It's all been done before, and there never seems to be a year that passes without the publication of some fresh, fanciful reconstruction of Jesus' life and death. That kind of speculative exercise may be commercially profitable, but it's of no real consequence. For the impact made by Christianity and the Church on 2,000 years of Western culture owes little to the comparatively trivial circumstances of its supposed founder's birth, life, and death, but much to the strangely compulsive nature of a faith that can turn sinners into saints and charming old men into born-again politicians, not entirely averse in the name of the Lord, to blasting the rest of the world into a philosophic conformity. The importance of this symposium seems to me that we're able to look at the Christian story in this larger perspective and to discuss the wider issues that take us beyond the minutiae of textual and historical criticism. As for the contribution of the Dead Sea Scrolls, well, the discovery of Essene texts from the Qumran caves presents us with a rather similar dual perspective. Donning our short focus spectacles, we can for the first time clarify the Semitic background of some technical religious phraseology in the Greek Testament. We can appreciate hitherto unrecognized specific doctrinal teachings, allusions, trace the extra-canonical sources of some elements of Christian teaching, and match the manner and substance of certain kinds of biblical interpretation. In the sectarian rules of conduct, we can even see clear patterns for the organizational structure and discipline of the early Christian communities, like the institution of the presbytery and bishopric, disciplinary procedures, standards of communal behavior, methods of joint funding, attitudes to women and sex, the theological basis for the practice of spiritual healing, and so on. But to appreciate the main importance of the scrolls for an understanding of Christian origins, we need to raise our eyes to a much wider perspective. As never before, it's becoming possible to understand how an exclusive, nationalistic movement like post-exilic Judaism could combine with an alienistic, dualistic philosophy to produce a kind of Jewish Gnosticism, and then in due course, under the heat and pressures of certain socio-political events over the turn of the era, be transformed into the even more unlikely Hellenistic hybrid of a messianic mystery cult, a scandal to any decent-minded Jew, and sheer nonsense to an intelligent Greek. How then, on such a long view, Can the scrolls help us to understand the person of Jesus of Nazareth? Well, not much, I think. In those early heady days after the public became aware that caves in the Judean wilderness had turned up really ancient Jewish documents dating from around the supposed time of Christ, popular speculation centered on the person of the man Jesus and his relationship to the Essenes. Had he perhaps been a member of the Qumran community at some time? Had those 40 days in the wilderness been spent in the monastery by the Dead Sea? Were the parallels between some aspects of his teaching and Essene thought due to such direct contact? Or came they by way of that mysterious prophet of the wilderness, John the Baptist? Alas, the scrolls make no mention of the Nazarene teacher by name. Indeed, the whole gospel tradition of a wine-bibbing associate of whores, pimps and quislings, a friend of Roman officers and an advocate of paying taxes to the enemy, has no parallel at all in what little we can glean from the scrolls about the manner of life of Jesus' Essene counterpart, the so-called teacher of righteousness. But then the Qumran writings have no literary parallel to the Synoptic Gospels. Nor do the Essenes seem to have shown any real interest in recording events in such narrative form. For them, the experience of their forefathers chronicled in the Bible was all the history they needed. Their own situation was but a repetition of what had gone before. In taking up their station on the outskirts of the Promised Land, they believed that they were reenacting the events of Joshua more than a millennium earlier, when he led the chosen people across the Jordan to prepare themselves for their entry into the land God had promised them. The Essene sojourn in their so-called house of exile was for these latter-day covenanters merely the turn of the circle, the foreordained rehearsal for the establishment of the new Israel and the institution of God's kingdom on earth. In other words, where there are parallels in the scrolls to the Christian story, they are for the most part more likely to be in the nature of a common mythology. And to seek in the documents detailed correspondences of time, place and persons is to misunderstand the nature of the Qumran texts and their authors' attitudes to history. The events that had affected them in their past were significant only so far as they could be related to biblical prophecy. They then served as signs of the times, to be noted, sometimes, though rarely, recorded, and then interpreted by their seers to determine their place in the eschatological timescale. Factors in the cosmological almanac by which men of understanding could recognize the proximity of the end time and the appearance among them of the Messiah or Christ, him who is to come. The question we now have to ask is whether the New Testament traditions, despite their easily read narrative style, are not to be understood similarly. Whether our onion peeling in search of the kernel of the historical Jesus is not itself misconceived. I believe it to be so. Even if there was a sectarian Jewish teacher living in Palestine during the first part of the first century called Joshua or Jesus, he had nothing at all to do with the crucified Christos of Paul's theology, thus had no part to play in the formation of that distinctive amalgam of faiths that eventually swept the world. I believe that the innocent collection of tales and sayings, which was apparently allowed to pass freely among the beleaguered cells of believers, in hourly danger of discovery and execution, was but a cover story. From that highly improbable account of a gentle rabbi, friend of little children, Roman tax collectors, and ladies with gynecological problems, could be distilled by skilled interpreters, well-versed in the art of rabbinic exegesis, as well as the abracadabra of Gnostic mysticism, secret passwords and sayings, the formulae for medicaments and hallucinatory drugs, the therapia in practice and prescription, which had earned them their reputation and name of Asaya Essenes, physicians. In the stories and adventures of the master and his followers may also be found more day-to-day reminders of communal regulative disciplines, and as the titles, qualifications,